So hello, everybody. Welcome to the Policy in Practice seminar series. We are delighted, Adnan Khan, Professor Miguel Santos, and of course, Jemima, who helps us with the with putting together these exercises. We're delighted to have Isabel San Malo as our guest this time. All of you have her bio and her long and extensive bio on many aspects of policy making in her native Panama, but not only there, but also internationally. Isabel is currently a senior advisor at the UNDP. She's also an advisor of UN Women at the regional office in Latin America and the Caribbean, particularly on the issue on finance and gender. She headed the Organization of American States mission, the observation mission on the presidential election in Ecuador just this year. She's a member of the Women's Leaders Network, also of the women's rights and advocacy groups in the region and internationally. And of course, she was vice president and minister of foreign affairs of her native Panama from 2014 until 2019. So she's a well-versed and experienced policymaker, as I said, in her native Panama, but also in the world, in international and multilateral fora. So we're delighted to have you here, Isabel, and we're delighted to listen to your presentation in this particular case, in a very relevant and hot topic, not only for Latin America, but the world as a whole, which is migration. And we're happy to listen to your presentation. And then, of course, we will have some comments and questions, and we will give the floor afterwards to the students. So welcome. Delighted to have you here. And please, Isabel, the floor is yours.
Vanessa, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you today, with the students. It's a pleasure to be with you, my longtime friend from many experiences, and my greetings to Professor Adnan as well, and my friend Miguel. I am surprised to see you there, and it's great to see you. My best regards as well to the students. It's a pleasure to have the opportunity to have this conversation with you today. I know I've been told you are all very experienced, and I know that you are all very interested in public policy, and I chose migration as the subject for the conversation today because it's an issue that it's there always, but it has its peaks and its valleys. And right now we are seeing a very, very high peak, particularly in my own region, Latin America. An hour and a half is nearly not enough to discuss everything that there is to discuss about migration. Seeing Miguel here, I would also love to go into what migrants contribute to countries because he's an expert at that. And there's a lot to say in that regard as well, but that will not be the focus today, at least not in the initial messages. So if you allow me, Vanessa, I will share my screen with the interest basically of having some figures that I hope will help and support the presentation. I am focusing on Latin America. Hold on 1 second. Forgive my lack of experience with this. Anyhow, I am focusing on Latin America, even though the migrant crisis is a global crisis. You have seen in the UK, in Europe, and I know you are students from all over the world. You have seen what happens all over the world, and we will look at the reality in Latin America today. The agenda that I will try to cover is basically 5 items. A little reference to global migration, some numbers and some history. I will share with you a particular view on my own country, Panama. As a transit country, we historically have not produced migrants of our own nationality, and we receive some migrants, but the peak of the problem right now is Panama as a transit country on the way to the United States. I will refer to Latin American migrants, particularly to the US, which is the main issue right now and has been the main issue for some years, referring to Central American, Venezuelans, Haitian minors. And then we will look at some past policies that we have adopted. Have they worked? Have they not worked? And I would like to refer lastly to the Global Compact for Migration, since I am totally convinced that migration will not stop. So we need to figure out ways of ensuring that migration is it's a transit within the legal framework and with the support that it requires, instead of just trying to close borders that I particularly don't think that is a solution. Anyhow, if we look at the history of the world, the recent history, in 2000, we had 173 million migrants worldwide. 2017, we had 258 million migrants. Of those, 36 million were children. So 36 million children, many of them unaccompanied, that's a tragedy. 124 million women, 150 million migrant workers, 25 registered refugees. In 2021, that number has gone up to 281 million migrants. And of course, the year is not over yet. Why do people migrate? Historically, people have migrated because of war, because of political and religious persecution, because of lack of economic sustainability, in search of better opportunities, and more recently, as a result of climate change. Disasters, earthquakes, and different kinds of climate change, natural impacts are making people not be able to remain in the place where they have always been and the need to move. The migration flow has changed. Over 200, 300, 500 years ago, as you see in the map on the, I guess it's my right, our right side, migration flow was from Europe to the Americas, from the north to the south. That has changed a lot. And today, migration is mostly from the south to the north. What's happening in Panama? Panama, we have the Darien Gap, which is this strip of land between Colombia and Panama where there is no road. It's a rainforest. It's a rainforest where drug trafficking groups have taken a hold. It's a rainforest where there are animals, there are dangers, there is human trafficking. And the Darien Gap is being crossed for the past decades by migrants finding it easier to arrive to the United States through South America and walking their way up to the United States. The majority of that route is through streets and communities, except the Darien Gap, which is through a rainforest full of dangers and full of obstacles. Many don't make it through the Darien Gap. What's happening in Panama? Panama has historically had an approach to migrants, which is very humane. Migrants are received by our security forces. They are placed in campgrounds. They are supported with health services. They're supported with food. Anyhow, the first points of entry at Darien are very, very small communities. And we see many times these tiny communities that have in numbers 10 times their size of migrants who are staying in these communities, which create opportunity for the community, but create a whole sort of other problems because again, these are communities, many of them without sewers or without water and or without electricity. So you see this avalanche of people competing for these services with the community. We have And I will refer here to what I believe is the first lesson from public policy, which has some positive results, but it's not a lasting solution anyhow. We have designed with Costa Rica what we call a controlled flow policy for migrants, which is why they are transported to Costa Rica by Panamanian authorities, and they are transported by bus and left at the Costa Rican border. So once they get to Panama, migrants are no longer on their own. They are accompanied, and I need to emphasize accompanied because they're not taken into custody, by our security forces and driven to Costa Rica. Let me also mention that none of these people wish to stay in Panama. Even though Panama is a pretty stable country, it's a country that has economic growth, and we have migrants from Central America mostly that have made it, they're living in Panama, but these migrants want to get to the United States. So the policy of controlled flow means that Panama will take fingerprints, will take biometric information, and will share with the United States, which is their end point of destination. We have found, in coordination with the United States, people who have a criminal history. In those cases, those are returned to their places of origin, but that's the minority. That is very, very rare. Mostly they're just received, fingerprinted, information exchange, and transported to Costa Rica. This policy was designed in 2015 when we had a very high peak of migrants. It's still today being followed by the current government. And just to give you some numbers, in the period of 2014 to 2019, when I was vice president and minister of foreign affairs, we had a total of 80,000 migrants those 5 years. In 2021, we already have that number for 1 year, and the year is not over. So we will have in 2021 a number larger than what happened between 2014 and 2019, which is a 5 year period of people trying to reach the United States. And these are some images that show very small highlights of what happens. The fact is that the transit through the Darien Gap is very dangerous on both sides, in Colombia and in Panama. And migrants know this. They know this before they attempt to travel. But their quest to escape oppression in their own countries, to escape economic hardships, insecurity, lack of opportunities, are such that they decide to take the risk anyhow. And we see in this transit, men, women, children, elders. We see people over 80 years old transiting with their family. We have received many small children whose parents died in the transit and arrived into Panama on their own, taken care by other migrants. And at the end, they will, most of them, continue on the way to the United States. Some Canada, but mostly on the way to the United States. This is a graph of a chart of 10 years. In the period between 2010 and 2020, migrants transiting through Panama, and I insist, this is a highlight because these are people that are coming all the way from South America to the United States. So this is a highlight of, it gives you an idea of what will happen in the border of the United States. So in these 10 years, we had a vast majority from outside of the Americas, Bangladesh, India, Congo, Nepal. And you will wonder, why would these people go to South America? Well, there are very flexible immigration policies at some countries in South America, particularly Brazil and Ecuador. So it's easy to fly to these countries and then start the transit up to the United States, because we all know it's not so easy to travel directly to the United States. So more than half are from outside of the of the Americas. Then we have a very large chunk of Haitians, a large chunk from Cuba. And Cuba, we will see the peaks, which is also related to public policies that have taken place in the past years. Let me refer a little bit to these particular peaks. The massive transit of Haitians, you all remember there was an earthquake in Haiti in 2010. So that made the flow of Haitians to the Americas very large back in 2010. But since this is Panama, this chart in Panama, you see Haiti, which is green, flat those years because Haitians flew to other countries. They did not transit then the Darien Gap. You see the green line taking a high peak in 2015. Why? Because Haitians were mostly in Brazil. Brazil had a very large construction effort in order to prepare the country for the 2014 Soccer Bowl. When that construction effort ended, they had to leave Brazil. There was then a lot of immigration opposition by Brazilians to Haitians, the whole issue of are they taking my jobs or not? And this comes up when economic job opportunities change. So that's when you see the green going up in 2015. Then it drops to 2017. Why does it drop? Because Chile, with Michelle Bachelet in government, sets up a policy where they welcome Haitians just with a tourist visa, and they prepare their applications for jobs and working visas while they're there. So that's why it dropped at that point in time. With Cuba, what happens here in 2014? Why is there such a high peak in 2013, 14, going up to 2015, and then it drops? We can all remember how the United States and Cuba's relations started to thaw in 2014, when then President Barack Obama announced the reopening of the embassy of the United States in Cuba. So that probably created a feeling of other opportunities or easier opportunities to arrive to the United States to come up. And then the rest of the migrants, we can also see that peak related to different policy issues. Central America. The Northern Triangle of Central America has been a region where, and Vanessa knows this very well because all of them transit through Mexico on their way north. Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador are countries where we see insecurity, very, very high insecurity, lack of opportunities, issues with violence, gangs. So being the Northern Triangle, a very dangerous place, it's one of those regions that creates many migrants trying to make it to the United States. In 2014, US authorities documented almost 70,000 unaccompanied children just from the Northern Triangle trying to enter into the United States. Once again, fleeing very difficult situations, violence, gangs. From 2007 to 2012, El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala had the highest femicide rates in the world. In the world. And I would like to highlight this because these are the humane situations that are making these flows change. Now, President Biden has made it a priority to have specific policies for the Northern Triangle. I think we have yet to see what impact these plans will have, because he has highlighted, which I celebrate, the importance of working on the root causes, but of course, working on the root causes is not something that's easy to do or that happens from one day to the other. Venezuelan migrants, from 1999 to the middle of 2019, over 4 million Venezuelans have left Venezuela. This does not include the circular migration, which constantly takes place between Colombia and Venezuela. President Duque has announced recently the possibility for Venezuelans to have a working permit for a number of years, other than the circular migration that permits Venezuelans living in Venezuela to go to Colombia during the day for work, to go to Colombia during the day for health services. So I would like to highlight here another public policy that has positive impact. When we define mechanisms for people to be able to transit to where they need to transit in a legal fashion, you diminish illegal flows. These, I believe, are some of the policies that we need to be exploring in the future to make it more regular, to make irregular migration regular and legal migration, because in illegal migration is where the dangers are and where the risks are for countries and for migrants as well. Haitian immigrants in the United States, you can see the sharp augmentation from 1980 here to 2018. And you can see here the what has happened after 2010 during that earthquake. And then of course they had another earthquake recently. Let me mention that Haiti is the only least developed country in the Americas. It's one of the poorest countries in the world. It has, as I have mentioned, been hit by devastating earthquakes, and it has faced political upheavals for the past decades, a lot of food scarcity, violence, a lack of social infrastructure. So people are really trying to just take care of their lives and their livelihoods when they exit. Here are some figures of minor apprehensions per country. I've already referred to this. We see Mexico in blue, Guatemala in green, Honduras, those are the three countries, and then El Salvador that have the highest numbers. And I particularly, I'm very concerned about migrants because once these children migrate, their school is affected, their opportunities for the future is affected, and they fall into limbos where there is no country responsible for safeguarding their rights as children. So I refer to some policies that have had some impact. These are not policies that will solve a problem, but that do make it perhaps easier or more humane. The control flow that I mentioned, which happens between Panama and Costa Rica with sharing biometrical information with the United States. With Mexico increasing deportations and immigration checks, of course you sort of halt or diminish the flow. Colombia, I've already mentioned the provision of 10-year visa to Venezuelans. And then the US wet feed, dry feed policy towards Cubans has also had a very big impact. Let me refer lastly to the Global Compact for Migration, which is not mandatory. Those countries that have signed, like my own, that doesn't mean that the country's obligated to pass particular policies, but the compact promotes safe, orderly, and regular migration and establishes the importance of our intergovernmental a framework in order for this to happen. What's next? In the Americas, this is a regional problem. We need a regional solution. We need to work within international agreements, and we definitely need to look at root causes. I would like, before going over to you, Vanessa, like to share a story of agreements between Panama and Mexico. When Vanessa was in office and President Peña Nieto was in office in Mexico, Nicaragua closed the borders. And when Nicaragua closed the borders, this really created a a very complicated situation for Costa Rica, for Panama. Costa Rica had to stop receiving migrants from Panama because they couldn't handle them anymore, and they could not move forward to Nicaragua because of the borders being closed to migrants. So Costa Rica was over, had an overflow of migrants. Panama had an overflow of migrants. And we were able then, with the support of the Mexican government and the initiative of Panama, and of course, in coordination with the United States as well, these were mostly Cuban migrants that were stranded in Central America on the way to the United States. We were able to have Mexico accept that Panama flies these migrants to the Mexican border. They were received by Mexican authorities, and then they were accepted into the United States by United States authorities. I believe that countries and governments need to evaluate situations as they change, and these are constantly evolving situations for migrants are constantly evolving, and we need to always have in mind that these are human beings fighting for their lives. And then again, I am not saying let's pretend that borders do not exist and let every, I understand that as countries, we need to have order and we need to be able to control our borders. But this is a reality that is not going to stop unless we're able to stop globally war, poverty, exclusion, lack of opportunities. And unfortunately, when we look at the Sustainable Development Goals and how they are how we are advancing towards them or not, I don't believe that we are in the short term going to resolve all of these situations around the world so that there is no migration. So I believe that we need to understand that migration is there, is here to stay, and we need to there find ways respecting our own national regulations and in the framework of international agreements, take always into consideration that these are human beings and try to find their ways not to go, Miguel, into what migrants can contribute to us, because that's a whole nother story. And it's the truth. Migrants also contribute to the countries where they finally settle. I'm gonna leave it at that, Vanessa, because I believe that we can have an interesting conversation, and thank you all for listening.
On the contrary, dear Isabel, thank you so much. Thank you for this very interesting, insightful, and thorough presentation on the challenges of migration, because definitely there's the experience of Panama, not due to geography and geopolitics, but also these can be replicated in terms of policy making in many different places in the world. So thank you for that. I would first start with either Adnan or Miguel or both. If you have comments, questions for Isabel, I have one on my own, but please go first. And then after that, we will pass the word to students so they can also make their questions.
Thank you very much, Vanessa. I don't know if Miguel wants to come in, but let me, to save time, maybe let me start. So thank you very much, Isabel, for a wonderful, wonderful talk on a subject that is hugely important in today's world, and that's going to become, if anything, far more important in the future. And a subject on which is a global subject, and countries like Panama and many other countries are in some ways caught in the middle because of geography, geopolitics, without having the necessary instruments at their disposal to fully deal with this. So it's mostly like coping mechanisms. And so my question to you is twofold. One is the scope for, call it like regional or international cooperation on this issue, which is not just a policing measure. And given that the statistic that you're showing is show that it's not just migration from Latin American countries to primarily the United States, but it's also like people from all over the world, Asia and other places also wanting to come in. So in other words, like a regional issue quickly has become a global issue. So what kind of scope do you see for international collaboration on this, given that it is the interest of different countries are so misaligned on this. My second part, which is more like the economics of it. So this is obviously like a hugely important and also a very divisive topic, become far more divisive in recent years. Economists do think of like maybe in terms of gains from trade. Are there systems in which one could think of like, I don't know whether temporary residential permits, temporary migration or others, which wouldn't deal with all of those drivers of migration. For instance, if it is the drivers are conflict, failed states, or maybe climate change, those perhaps require action in those countries through aid, economic cooperation, and other measures. But where migration is driven by economics, mismatch between wages and economic insecurity, what scope do you see for measures that take advantage of the, call it the potential gains from trade, maybe not permanent migration as people are saying, maybe temporary migration of the type that helps the home communities and maybe the host communities also in some ways. And if yes, what are the main barriers around those? Are those around commitment or coordination, enforcement? Where do you see major barriers and the scope for cooperation? Thank you again.
Thank you so much, Anand. But these are very, very interesting questions. First, on the call for cooperation, we are not going to solve this unless there is cooperation. I am not too positive in the short term for this cooperation. If we look at recent history in Latin America, we have been, even though there have been some agreements, bilateral agreements, like for particular situations, like when I mentioned with Mexico to fly Cubans there, or with Costa Rica, other than that, we have not seen in our own region regional frameworks working. And when we look at other regions, I remember, I believe it was in the 2000s that the European Union, which has a long history of cooperation, which the Americas does not have, reached an agreement. I believe it was before the Syrian big exodus started. And this agreement established that the country that was first reached by migrants or refugees had to deal with the permits. It fell through. It didn't have more than 2 years of agreements, because at the end, what you've mentioned is what dominates. Particular interests dominate over regional interest. And that's understandable, because when we are in government, you need to choose your battles. Political capital is not, you have a number. You have some capital. It's not infinite. I don't know if that's the word. So at the end, and these are things that generate a lot of opposition within countries. The image of foreigners taking the jobs that I am not getting, even though it's not true in many cases, it's an image that is too hard to fight. And it makes governments very, very unpopular. And since most of the time while in government, politicians are looking for re-election, this is very complicated. I remember, you know, I came into politics in a not common fashion at all. I've never belonged to a political party. I did not have a political career. All of a sudden I was invited to join a ticket. Anyhow, I said yes, and oh my God, we won. And so there I was. So I did not have then a political agenda, and I ended my mandate, and I have gone back to my life as I knew it before, which I enjoy very much. So I took many decisions that were not too popular. And I remember the president many times telling me, you know, you can't do this. And it was hard to argue for cases within a government because the political measurement is always there. And I'm not criticizing it. It's understandable. So I'm not too, I have to say, I'm not too positive in the short term, but we need to continue fighting for that because it's the only way that we're going to be able to solve it on the economics of it. Take the United States right now. The United States right now, it's not finding enough workers for the economic recuperation that's taking place. All over the place in the United States, you see vacancy notices. Businesses are not finding applicants for the jobs that they need to fill. Ports in the United States are overflowed with containers that are not being able to be unloaded in many cases due to the shortage of transportation. And then you have all of these migrants that would probably love to take any job that is offered to them, but there are legal constraints. So if politics, if this was a game, we could say, this is so easy, you know? You need the workers, you can't find them here, let's give the migrants the legal permit, at least temporarily, but it just doesn't happen that way because there are other elements. So that's what I could mention now. It's not too helpful because I'm not providing a solution. I'm just adding more to the complications of the issue, but that's a reality.
Thank you. These are extremely complex challenges and no one has any solution, but I think your perspective is very enlightening. Thank you.
Well, hi, Isabel. It is a pleasure to see you. Isabel was the vice president of Panama when the Growth Lab worked there in 2015, then came to the Kennedy School as a visiting fellow of the Institute of Politics while I was working there. Then she has been invited to my class at the University of Chicago, so it's a pleasure to see you here as well. I think you're bringing up a separate point because I truly believe that one of the most understudied topics is the immigration politics for developing countries. Like we always focus on why in Europe, why in the US, why in Canada, why it is so hard to get people from developing countries and how bad that is for migrants. And we rarely focus on how close developing countries are to receiving new people. And even in cases where it is evident that foreigners come to complement and not substitute locals, what you have said is just right. It is extremely hard. And it's so counterintuitive for local people to understand that there were jobs are going to be created because foreigners are coming that wouldn't be created otherwise. Foreigners are always coming to come and take the best positions or take my job away. But you're talking about a different problem, which is this massive migrations, right? Like this massive amount of people you got from Venezuela. It's interesting that in the region, as the number increased, the sentiment changed. For instance, in Peru, under President Pedro Pablo Kuczynski, there was a huge opening at the beginnings. Venezuelans were given like job permits at the entrance immediately. And there was a massive solidarity. And when that number grew and grew and went beyond 500,000, then you started seeing like a pushback. And at least with respect to the Venezuelan crisis, I wanted to ask you about your experience in funding, because it's one of the most underfunded refugee crises in the world. I mean, the record is that it's the second largest after Syria. Syria had a migrant record up to until last year of 6.7 million people. And if you add across Brookings Institute this exercise, all the funds going to them, they gathered $20 billion. Well, Venezuelans up to last year were up to 5.5 million migrants. And if you add across all the programs, you get to 1.5 billion. So it's a crisis that is there. It's affecting neighboring countries, eventually will affect others because some are in transit. I wonder if ever you reach out or you've been present in instances where this cooperation, Adnan, asked was discussed? What's the reaction? If this is an issue that is not important to people, is it hard to draw attention to them? What's your experience on that?
Thank you, Miguel. Resources for cooperation have been diminishing globally, not in number, but in terms of access, because there are more needs, there are more countries, so resources have been going down. Other than that, Latin America has a huge problem, which is that we are a middle-income continent. But we are a middle-income continent populated not by a middle class. Here comes the issue also of inequality in Latin America, which is the most unequal, as you know, the most unequal continent in the world. So by numbers, we don't qualify for cooperation. So yes, there are very limited resources for Venezuelan migrants, and there are very limited resources even for Haitian migrants, which is a least developed country, but falls within Latin America. So Latin America is a region which has a very, very complicated problem accessing resources, because when you look at development in Africa and in Latin America, we are just rich, but we're not. So I could not agree with you more. There is a huge problem. And I continue to argue, and I have argued many times, particularly with the United States, which is our next door neighbor. It's a superpower that's here, that it is in the interest of the United States that the region does better. And I constantly argue that this middle income trap where we are needs to be addressed somehow. And this takes us as well to the root causes, because the Northern Triangle, it's normal that a father who has children, that he cannot feed properly, that he knows his children are going to be trapped into gangs that are going to push for them to join the gangs, and that this children are not going to have other opportunities than joining the gangs. It's normal that he will try to migrate, whatever the risks involved. So the issue of resources is a huge issue, even for the crisis right now of the transit migrants. Countries on the way are really dealing with this on their own. And there are massive amounts of resources that go into health, food, security, which is taken away from populations of our own that require it as well. So you have highlighted a very, very important problem that we need to address as well. How and where do we find the resources to address these challenges? Because they're very, very limited.
Thank you.
Thank you, Isabel. And just before I turn the word to students, I absolutely feel what you're saying and how difficult and complex this issue of migration is, and how we view it most of the time as a crisis. But there's crisis within the crisis, no? So I remember in my time when I was Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs in Mexico, I had to deal with the unaccompanied minor migrants crisis. And there was a complete different scenario to the regular migration crisis we are used to handling from Central America, from Haiti, from other parts of the world. Because in this specific moment in 2014, 2015, we had 8-year-olds traveling with their siblings that were 4 years old and 2 years old by themselves from a little town in Honduras all the way to Florida, and they had to go through Central America, then through Mexico, and then to reach their parents or their closest relative in the United States. And we were looking at all these massive numbers that were increasing significantly, we were trying to understand what the pushing factor and what the pulling factor was in this juncture. And the pushing factors were the ones that you just described, no? Lack of opportunity, violence, gangs. But then they were structural. But then what was the pulling factor there? And the pulling factor was actually a very good policy that was a part of a policy in the United States called DACA, which is the Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals, which the gangs and the drug traffickers in Central America used to abuse the people and give them wrong information about the possibility of those young kids to be accepted in the United States while they went to trial, no? And in the meantime, while they were expecting for that trial to resolve their situation, they were basically reunited with their family. So they sold that as a new policy saying, you are going to be given permisos, you're going to be given permits in the United States to go with your family, no? So that's where the problem started. We of course had to deal with it in a couple of years, but we needed to explain this also to Mexican society, because the reaction was harsh and they were saying, no, but you need to give permits to the kids to stay in Mexico. We need to give adoption policies in Mexico. And we needed to explain to them that those kids weren't looking for a place in Mexico. They had their grandparents in Central America. They had their parents in the United States, and Mexico was just the transit country that they were using to make that journey. That very risky journey, by the way, for youngsters. But anyhow, I just have a question for you, Isabel, and it's, how does Panama handle the bilateral relationship with the United States in terms of two different, very different policy options you can pursue in this context? One is what you said you were doing, which is basically helping migrants transit through the Darien and transiting through Panama in order to get them in a safe way throughout Panama, and even have information on them and their biometrics and sharing that information with the United States. And the second policy option, which is basically stopping them from moving and from passing from Panama, no? Because at some point they will actually are going to be stopped either in Mexico or in the United States. So how do you deal in your relationship with the United States with those two policy options, which are basically contradictory and are very different in terms of outcome and the way you deal with that policy?
Thank you, Vanessa. That's a critical issue. And it's always an issue in our bilateral agenda with the United States, I am sure it is for you as Mexican. It's always a complicated. Let me first express, as part of the framework that allows the collaboration and the understanding with the United States, the fact that Panama is a very, very strong ally of the United States in the fight against drugs. Our security forces, the work and the resources that our security forces devote to fighting drug trafficking is enormous. And this is done in collaboration with the United States, with the support of the United States. For the United States, it's very, very important that as much drug as can be stopped in Panama is stopped in Panama, because the fact is that once it goes through Panama, it's probably going to end up in the United States. So whatever we take out of the market here, it's an important collaboration for the United States. So our bilateral agenda with the US is very strong in terms of security. And I believe this allows for some room and some maneuvering for other issues like the migrant issues. So it's a fact that the numbers transiting through Panama are too large for Panama to handle in terms of them staying here. Number two, they don't want to stay here. It's not like it's an option. They don't want to stay here. Because our borders are very, I guess you say in Spanish, porosos. I don't know how you say this in English, but our borders are very open with Colombia and with Costa Rica. A rainforest on the one side and on the other, we have a transit route. But I mean, there are some parts in the border with Costa Rica where there is land ownership and you're not really sure if it belongs to Costa Rica or Panama. So it's virtually impossible to retain in Panama people that do not want to stay in Panama unless you really apply force to them. And given our capacity, that would be a decision that would also impact the United States in another way. Are we going to devote part of our security efforts to just returning people? You want us to do that, that's going to take efforts away from drug trafficking. As simple as that. Number two, there are frameworks that promote the humane and the human rights of migrants, just preventing you from prohibiting people from transiting from through a country where they want to transit through. So I believe in our bilateral relationship, because of all of these issues, we were able to come to that agreement of we are going to deport those that have criminal records. In collaboration with you, we will check for those records. And the rest, we're just going to let them transit. Because if we're going to look at, you know, the problem is in Panama, then why don't we look at the problem in Colombia? I mean, they don't enter through Colombia. They enter through Ecuador, or they enter through Brazil. So I guess that same approach, you could take it farther south. So that's how we've handled it and come to that agreement, which I agree with you, is just pushing a problem farther north.
Thank you so much. And definitely the margin of maneuver that you have vis-a-vis your cooperation on security and drugs, you know, gives you a more ample margin. So it's good to see you, Carmine. Please, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Vanessa. Good to see you back indeed and everyone on this call. But let me start by a big thank you. Muchísimas gracias to Isabel for an excellent presentation. Just to very briefly introduce myself, I'm a development economist at the World Bank, an economic advisor to Italy's Minister of Finance for the G20 presidency, and a student at the School of Public Policy at LSE. I come from Italy, as you might have told, Isabel, and to a certain extent, the fascinating story you told us about Panama, in a way reminded me of Italy as a transit country for migrants coming from sub-Saharan Africa on their way to central continental Europe, primarily Germany, to a lesser extent, Austria and Scandinavian countries. And yet, as you might have heard, and you probably know because you mentioned that the Dublin Agreement, which is the framework we have in the EU to handle migration flows, which as you correctly recognized, hasn't worked very well, particularly unwell for us, the Italians, the Spanish, the Greeks, and all of the others on the forefront of the EU borders, the Mediterranean borders. You know, things have gone very differently, because I would have loved to see a situation where we had buses shuttling migrants from Sicily all the way to the Austrian borders, but then I can't picture Austria taking those migrants in, right? Maybe Germany would, but we don't share a border with the Germans, unfortunately. So I guess I have a two-part question about the politics of all of this. Part one has been somehow anticipated by Vanessa's excellent question, and it's about the narrative that you had to use with the United States to convince them. It's very clear to me what you just said about your cooperation on drug prevention, etc. But I would be tempted to also assume that your leverage might also change significantly depending on which administration is sitting in Capitol Hill. And so I wonder whether you can spare a word or two in terms of how that leverage might have changed over the past few years, considering the very different approaches we've seen in US immigration policy between, you know, two administrations ago, the previous administration, and now this one. And then the second part of the question, still on the politics of it, is about how these massive influxes of migrants into Panama might have impacted political preferences among your fellow citizens. As you certainly know, at least in the EU, these major influxes have led to the rise of anti-immigrant, far-right extremist political platforms, certainly in Italy, but also to a certain extent in Greece, in Hungary, Spain, etc. And I'm wondering whether the same has happened to a certain extent in Panama, maybe in Costa Rica, and how you guys might have dealt with it from a political narrative perspective. But other than that, again, thank you very much. It was super interesting.
Thank you, Carmen, for your fantastic question. For sure, the dialogue changes from administration to administration. But I guess the impact that we could feel was on other areas. The security, the conversations on security issues are very stable between Panama and the United States, irrespective of administration. The fight against drug has been a constant for the US agenda, and the agenda for security in the hemisphere has been a constant on the US agenda, irrespective of whoever is the president at a given time. So that is not so impacted, and it's really led by, in the side of the United States, it's really led by career people. And the policy remains pretty stable. I need to say that Latin America pretty much saw an absence of US attention while President Trump was in office. So it's not that the dialogue changed, it's that the dialogue pretty much stopped. Of course, you know, the agenda was always there, but if you look at the presence of ambassadors from the United States to the region during that administration, there were many places, including my own, that were with Shayed Affairs for a long time. So there were other issues that were important for the bilateral agenda between Panama and the United States during the Trump administration. For example, the fact that Panama established a relation with the People's Republic of China, and Panama having the Panama Canal. I mean, that was an issue that really, you know, was highlighted in red and all colors, and an issue that really concentrated the agenda. Migration, it just kept happening as business as usual. You know, there's this transit that goes on, that is dealt with, that, and it was not a major part of the agenda. Things like the changing policy towards Cuba had a big impact on the geopolitics of the region and the agenda of the region with the United States. It were more ideological, if I can mention it somehow. So yes, there are changes in style and policy, but I cannot say that, other than the China issue, I cannot say that in the case of Panama, there was something. So I would guess that the political preferences, as you mentioned, during the Trump years were more dominated by global geopolitical issues and then other issues between Panama and the United States on the economic side, investments, not so much, for example, the issue of migrants.
Thank you, Isabel. Now the turn of James, please.
Hi, Isabel. Thank you so much for your presentation. Really, really nice to hear your experience, and also the topic is
always very exciting. My question is,
you know, there are like many shades of gray, I would say, like when you talk about migration policies, yeah, in the different countries. So you can have like a complete, let's say, open system, which does not exist, actually, I think, in any country, to a complete like closed system. But there are like other measures, such as the Canadian system of points or the German system of looking internally to see whether the person that is coming has the same skills as the local people and so on. So my question is like, from your perspective and experience, what is the, let's say, the best system that exists nowadays, and what is the, which country is doing that, and what should we aim? I would say, like, that's my main question. Thank you.
Thank you, James. That's a great point. When you mentioned Canada and you mentioned Germany, I had to think of institutional capacity in our countries, because we have so many issues and weaknesses in terms of our institutions that I guess it's going to take a number of years before we have the capacity to have a coherent, sustainable migration policy that takes into consideration things like what you're mentioning. You know, let's evaluate and let's figure out what sort of capacities we need, what abilities we need, and then allow this. We have, in the case of Panama, done some of that with some special, what we call special zones, special economic zones, where within these special economic zones, we allow for different migratory policies. For example, we have a policy that promotes global multinationals to establish their headquarters in Panama. And if they do, they have the possibility of bringing a number of foreign workers. But for that, this multinational needs to register within this framework, needs to establish itself within this physical piece of land for that. But I think you're totally right. That's part of the way forward. The world needs different types of workers. Countries need different types of workers at given times. Panama knew before the expansion of the canal that in order to expand the canal, we were going to need foreign workers. We knew that, and we made it possible. But that was a very important project for the country. I doubt that we have the capacity, but I think it will be ideal. And I think there are some countries that are models, and you've mentioned them, Canada, Germany, that have specific migration policies that are beneficial to their country while they also give escape routes to people looking to live in their country for different reasons. We know we have some Venezuelan people in Panama that are here under asylum. And because Panama does not allow foreign professors within our universities, we have some of these people with a permit to be here because they have asylum who were professors in their own country with the experience, and our education is in pretty bad shape. So it's like, you know, we could work. But like if Miguel wanted to come work in the University of Panama, he could not because he's not Panamanian. I mean, this is crazy. And this is something I faced and fought while in government, and the opposition to that. And then we go again to the political capital issue. You know, you need to choose your battles and figure out how you're going to spend that political capital. So I think in the way forward, those are some of the things that we need to be looking at. If we create formal legal ways for workers to move, they will avoid other dangerous options. But the fact is that we're not globally allowing for enough possibilities for legal movements as the world requires, not nearly enough.
Thank you so much.
I don't see any other raised hands at this point in time from the students, but I will take opportunity of having you here to, to make another comment and question to you, Isabel. And here I will take advantage of the fact that I know your many other facets in terms of being a policymaker in several aspects. We were talking about geopolitics and geopolitics in the Western Hemisphere and the United States being the superpower it is. But there is also a very interesting relationship in the region with another power. And I'm talking about China here. And there's many countries in the region that have had and that have a very special relationship with China. And Panama is one of them. And I would like to hear a comment from your side on how this other superpower, China, has been having a special relationship with the Western Hemisphere vis-a-vis you know, the power of the United States in terms of geopolitics and geoeconomy, and how Panama has handled this twofold relationship, the very close relationship with the United States that you were describing in terms of trade, in terms of the, of course, the Panama Canal, in terms of the combat of drug trafficking and security issues. And how has Panama seen this other possibility of a relationship, of a very close relationship and a very strategic relationship with China? And of course, I'm moving to another topic, one that I know that you are an expert in, and I think our students would love to hear a comment from you on that too.
I will thank you, Vanessa, because that's definitely an area that I think is very important for the region and that I love to have the opportunity to exchange with you. I'll give you a short answer and then I'll give you the long answer. The short answer, how was it handled? Very carefully. That it does it, you know, with a lot of care, because it's very delicate. It's a balance that is very, very delicate. And I'm going to share with you and the students how it happened that Panama went about establishing relations with China. I'll tell you the story. But before I go into that, I'm a firm believer, and this is what I have shared with the United States over and over. Countries, particularly developing countries, need to first and foremost, and not only developing countries, all countries need to first and foremost pay attention to their own interests, to their own needs, to their own realities. So if there are benefits from having a relationship with China, why would anybody intend to make us choose? You know, we don't need to choose. We are a sovereign country. I believe, I am convinced that the strategic bilateral relationship that Panama has had historically, has today, and will continue to have with the United States is very important, is very valuable to Panama, is strategic to Panama, and we need to take care of it. So establishing relationship, a diplomatic relations with China, even though China is superpower, in no way was intended as a way of saying we are shifting and now are, in terms of superpowers, our relationship with China is, we're not comparing it to the relationship with the United States. It's just a fact that there are interests, it is in Panama's interest to establish a relation with China for a number of reasons. And I think that the absence, particularly during the Trump years, but in general, the absence of the United States from the region and the interest of China to have presence in the region, and the Belt and Road Initiative and other initiatives that are very interesting, make a scenario which it's really not fair to expect countries to, just because somebody else thinks that it should be that way, expect this region to not have relationship with China. So Panama had several times before my government tried to establish diplomatic relations with China. And some things have gotten in the way and it had not been possible. So actually, China was quite hurt in a way from these attempts that had not happened. So for us, it was not too easy. It was something that President Varela and I discussed before taking office, that it was a step that Panama needed to make, but I make an emphasis of it having been tried before because it was something that Panama was ready for. It was not something that my government said, oh, let's take this step. It was something that Panamanians were ready for. I don't know if you know, but there is a very large Chinese community in Panama for many years. Chinese came to Panama to build the railroad before the canal was built. A very large community of Chinese. So you have about 10% of our population that is of Chinese descent, and Chinese have made a living in Panama. They are a prosperous business community and they're part of who we are. So that's one thing. Another thing is that we're a global country. We've been a global country forever. So as soon as we entered office in 2014, we started sending messages to China. For example, you might remember, Vanessa, because I believe you were at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs then, that the CELAC meeting between Latin America and China in January 2015 was in Beijing. How I was vice president and foreign minister, it would have been a little bit too much to have an authority of my level travel to China, to a country where we did not have diplomatic relations with, even if within the framework of a multilateral effort like CELAC. But I did send my vice minister, which is a pretty high level authority to participate in an event in a country where you don't have diplomatic relations. And my vice minister had one objective: be sure to send the message that we want to establish relations with China. And he did, and there was no answer. And we sent several messages like that for about 3 years without hearing back. I guess it was the fact that the president in office in Taiwan at the time still had the collaboration with China, so they had an agreement to respect each other's partners, and we had relations with Taiwan at the time. So that was an issue. And I think that the issue of the distrust with Panama was very important there as well, because several times before, the road had been traveled to establish relations, and at the last minute, Panama had backed out. So in 2017, when we saw a message that, okay, let's talk about this. And then we started negotiations and we were ready to sign relations. I remember we were in May and we had a visit to President Trump in July, approved. President Varela and I were visiting Washington for a meeting with the president that was set. So when we hear back from China that, okay, you know, we can do this, I said, be sure, my representative, I said, be sure to let them know that this needs to happen in June. And that was very fast. You know, the time frames for China and for Latin America are very different. For us, everything is like, you know, let's do it now, let's do it. For China, they have millions of years of history, so things have a different time frame. So when we came and said this needs to happen in June, they were like, why? Well, you know, why so soon? What's the rush? Because we were weeks away from June. And I said, because we were visiting the United States and you know, this is our partner. I'm not going to sit across the table from the president of the United States and not let them know that we are having these negotiations. But we had made a point with President Varela to maintain the confidentiality of the conversations because we did not want to have it broken by any outside forces. So we did, and I was in Beijing 1 week before we went to Washington, exactly 1 week. That was signed on a Monday, and the Monday after that, we were at the White House. And I believe that was positive. I mean, you could say it was risky, but I think in the framework of the transparent relations we have with the United States, we needed to be able to sit face to face and tell them this in no way intends to affect our strategic relationship with the United States. We are doing this because of this, of this, of this. This is in the interest of Panama for X number of reasons. And in general, just to go back to your reference of Latin America, we have many challenges. And in facing and overcoming those challenges, we need to collaborate with different partners. And I believe China is one of them, as of course is the United States.
Thank you so much, Isabel. This is fascinating. And this takes us to another series of comments in relation to, again, the margins of developing countries to exercise this sovereignty in a wise way, to exercise their interests in a wise way, and to be open to broadening the spectrum of the relationships and actually engage in a series of diversification processes in practice. But we have here, I think, what it is our youngest student at the SPP, and she's actually from China. Ruiying, please, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Thank you for your presentation. And I'm Ruiying from China, and I'm a woman who wants to start her career as a policy advocate in the future. And I see that you are an expert in gender policy, and I'm currently working on a gender policy program in Vanessa's seminar. So I'm curious about how are the gender policies in Panama, and how can we put forward some excellent policy practices in one country to all of the countries in the world? Thank you.
Thank you for that question. And yes, gender was one of the priorities in my agenda. And I can tell you some things that I'm proud of. For example, when we took office, our Supreme Court had no women, not one. And we made it a point to push for, I made it a point to push for female. It was something I had to really argue at the cabinet level with not too much support from many of my colleagues. And we were able to nominate some female candidates to Supreme Court. And today, with the new government's decision, just 2 weeks ago, today there are more women in Panama's Supreme Court than men. And almost half and half, but so I believe that's very important. I mean, women are half the population, a little over half of the population. So if we exclude women from decision-making, we are not going to have the vision and the approach of half of a population in that decision making. And that hurts everyone. Women participation is not because of women, it's it's to build a better society, it's to be build a better future. And I will also mention another policy that I pushed and was approved, and I believe is starting to make some important changes, because women in Panama have, for the longest time, been very active, professional. We graduate more women than men from universities for decades now. And you see women in the workforce. But when you get to the leadership positions, then the presence starts to diminish. And when you look at boards, it's very, very limited. So I was able to promote a legislation that was approved to ensure at least a third of board membership to be women. And that included not only public boards, but boards of sectors that are regulated, such as banking, insurance, and all sorts of regulated, important regulated economic sectors. So I think that has started a shift and created opportunities. And I do believe that for the sake of humanity, not for the sake of women, but for the sake of humanity, we need to understand that making space for women at the political level, at the professional level, works in everyone's interest.
Thank you so much, Isabel. We're getting to the end of the talk. I don't see any other hands raised at this point in time. It's been great to have you with us here today, not only to discuss the topic you presented, migration, such a complex issue for Latin America and for the world, and the policy options, you know, in terms of administering and of course, dealing with the juncture and also the root causes of migration, but also to be as kind enough to share your thoughts on these geopolitical aspects in the Western Hemisphere in terms of the US and the China relationship. And also what you have been advancing in terms of gender also as a public policy that is needed, as you said, not only for women, which of course are half of the population, but also mothers of the other half. And that's the systemic relevance, but also for, you know, for inclusion as a whole and for more equitable societies and for more prosperous countries. So thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to have you here. Hopefully next time we can see you in person and we can have you in person at the school. And thank you. You're always invited to come join the SPP and the SPP students are grateful, I'm sure, for the time they spent today with you.
Vanessa, thank you so much for the invitation. It's been a pleasure to see you again, to see my friend Miguel again and Professor Amat and all of the students. Thank you so much for the opportunity and I hope we can meet again.
Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you, Isabel. Great to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye.